From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Sudan's longtime president Omar al-Bashir was ousted by a military coup. Months of mass protests, during which dozens of people were killed by security forces, paved the way for the ouster. Al-Bashir had himself come to power more than 30 years ago as a result of a military coup. In addition to national anger over his decades of rule, the ousted president was charged by the International Criminal Court over genocide in Darfur. Sudan's defense minister, Awad ibn Auf, has declared himself interim leader, saying that there would be a two-year transition period during which the military would remain in charge. Already, the military has begun cracking down, however, with the imposition of a month-long curfew. We turn to Dr. Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he also serves as coordinator of the program in Middle East Studies. And he's a senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and associate editor of Peace Review. Welcome, Dr. Stephen Zunis.
Great to be with you again.
So let's first get a little bit of a history lesson on Sudan. Unfortunately, we don't hear enough or know enough here in the United States about the history of this country. I mentioned that al-Bashir had been ruling for about 30 years and had come to power as a result of a military coup. But his rule was, in a way, a very dark time for Sudan. Can you give us the highlights, or I should say the lowlights, of his dictatorship?
Well, Sudan, a former colony of Britain, a multi-ethnic society, though traditionally dominated by the Arabs in the north, received independence in the 1950s, and the military has intervened a number of times. So quite significantly, in both 1964 and 1965, the people rose up in an unarmed civil insurrection, similar to what we've seen in recent weeks, to bring down those dictatorships and usher in a period of multi-party democracy and political freedom. It was after the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Nimeiri dictatorship in 1985 that democracy governed that country for 4 years, making it one of the most democratic countries in the Arab world or in Africa, until the right-wing Islamist wing of the very broad civilian coalition ended up allying itself with the military and staged the coup that brought Bashir to power. And during this period, has overseen an enormous amount of turmoil, the secession of the southern part of the country to form the new nation of South Sudan, simultaneous civil wars, the worst of which, of course, was in Darfur, where a genocidal campaign by the Janjaweed militia with direct support of the government took place for quite a few years. It's still a bad situation, though the worst appears to be over. But Bashir's role in that made him the only sitting president in the world to be under indictment by the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, domestic repression was quite severe. The once very strong trade union network and civil society networks that had existed in Sudan, even under some of the previous dictatorships, were brutally suppressed. And yet resistance continued in 1998 and 2011 and 2012. There were aborted uprisings against the regime. But due to increasing economic hardships and growing dissatisfaction with the regime and its corruption, its repression, and a whole new generation of Sudanese who've grown up under the regime and wanting change have come together and have forced Bashir's resignation.
So this latest series of protests, did it sort of reach a breaking point? I mean, I understand that it was, as is the case with many such rebellions against longtime dictatorships, there might be one thing that sparks it, one action that seems to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, if you will, but still represents a very long-standing dissatisfaction and anger and resentment from the public?
Well, there's no one incident in this particular case, so that is certainly a phenomenon in some places. I think it was just yet another wave that they've had of these repeated waves of protests. But for various reasons, I think in large part the worsening economy gave it the critical mass that was really important. And what was also significant, I think, is that it went beyond Khartoum, the capital, and it's been taking place in urban areas throughout the country, and even including in some rather remote regions. You had the unity of professional workers and others who have been able to essentially bring the capital to a standstill. The sheer numbers were greater than ever before. And also significant is the unprecedented participation of women. By some estimates, the majority of protesters are women who, in addition to the other complaints the rest of Sudan has, they have been challenging the very sexist, patriarchal, conservative Islamist rule. And so it's been a real coming together of various parts of Sudanese society. And at this point, they had the numbers and the courage and whatever to bring down not the regime yet, but certainly the worst manifestation of the regime and in the form of Omar Bashir. But what's significant, I think, also about this is that you hear people say, well, nonviolence can work in thus and such situations, but not against a really, really brutal regime. But by almost every measure, Sudan ranks up there as one of the three or four most repressive regimes in the world. And another significant thing about this is, despite our stereotypes of, oh, this kind of thing can't work unless a society has a fairly high level of development and infrastructure and whatever, Sudan ranks near the bottom in the world in terms of the Human Development Index. That combined with the these ongoing armed conflicts around the country with the ultra-conservative Islamist rule, despite the limited internet and other technologies and low level of education, despite all these things, they show that even in these situations, that people, when they want change, when they're willing to face down the tanks with their bare hands, that people power can prevail.
I want to pick up on what you said about the role of women and ask you how they participated. There, of course, was this viral video of a young woman dressed in all white, addressing a huge crowd of protesters, singing a song about revolution that helped to break the story of Sudan into the international media. And in fact, let's watch a little bit and listen to a little bit of her her song. Very, very beautiful and inspiring song. I don't know if it's clear yet who she is, but here is the viral video of a Sudanese female protester. Watching a video of, or listening to a video of, a young Sudanese woman addressing a very large crowd gathered around her as she sings a song. Media have pointed out that on one of her cheeks is an older version of the Sudanese flag painted on her. How important was this moment that was captured on film and spread in media throughout the world? Sometimes this sort of symbolism can be quite inspiring, but also give a lot of wind to the sails of a movement.
Well, it certainly is already become something of an iconic photo or video that has indeed inspired a lot of people around the world and given an opportunity to pay attention to a country, though large and important in many ways, is generally ignored, particularly in the West. But I don't even think it was that big a deal in Sudan, simply because very few Sudanese have access to the internet and that kind of thing. I think sometimes there's a tendency in the West to overemphasize new technologies in terms of bringing these movements forward. But there was no internet, no social media during the uprisings, 1964, 1985. This uprising would be happening anyway. Because when people believe there's freedom is denied, social justice is denied, they will be active. They will take to the streets. They will take these kinds of risks. And the fact is that again, despite our stereotypes we have in the West about Arabs or Africans or Muslims, regardless of your background, I mean, people don't like to be oppressed. People don't like to have their rights denied, and women are often affected at least as much as men by this kind of repression and social injustice. So it's really not surprising that you see this kind of mass movement out there.
So let's talk about what has happened specifically around Omar al-Bashir's ouster. The military stepped in, and just as he came to power 30 years ago as a result of a military coup, we now have the defense minister of Sudan somewhat declaring power. And that's not really clear, actually, because it's so new what has happened. But essentially, the military announced it would take over, announced a two-year transitional period, paving the way for elections, but also imposed a very strict curfew. Between at nighttime, no one's allowed to go out for a whole month. They have this curfew. They are apparently going to be enforcing it quite strictly. And we're hearing that members of the opposition or some leaders in the opposition are not happy, understandably so. How do you analyze this transition of power? Can the military be trusted?
No, it cannot. And most Sudanese recognize this. The military doesn't quite have the aura of the Egyptian military or the Algerian military.
And you brought up Egypt. Al-Sisi in Egypt actually praised what had happened in Sudan, which shouldn't be a good sign.
Right, exactly. And what's interesting, though, is that in 1985, when the masses rose up and overthrew the Nimeiri regime, a very similar thing happened. The military came in and formally deposed him and said, okay, the dictator's gone, we're in charge now, y'all can go home. And the Sudanese people said, we're staying. We're going to keep on protesting until you have a transition to civilian rule. And within a week, that's exactly what happened. The military stepped down and made the transition to a temporary representative civilian government, which then organized the elections a few months later. And so and it's very clear from all the communication I've heard is that the Sudanese who have been out on the streets do not see this as the end of the struggle at all, that they realize that it must continue. It could be a protracted struggle even, but they're not buying the line that everything's cool now that the military is in power. Indeed, the defense chief who's taken over is himself responsible for some of the worst atrocities in Darfur and elsewhere, and people aren't buying it. I mean, it is possible, that the military could crack down. We could see a massacre. I mean, there is a pretty high level of danger still. But it's been significant that the protesters indeed have not gone home. They have been disobeying the curfew that's been imposed. And another significant point, I think, is that there is a whole new generation of younger officers who, even if they are ordered to crack down by the interim leadership, they won't necessarily obey these orders. There are already reports that there are some units who are very dissatisfied with what happened, and they're supporting the Sudanese people and calling for a genuine transition to democratic civilian rule.
So the defense minister, Awad Mohammed bin Auf, what has the relationship between him and Omar al-Bashir been? If you mentioned that he was complicit in the genocide in Darfur, and Omar was charged by the International Criminal Court on that, then really what makes him any different from Bashir, al-Bashir?
And not a lot. I mean, the military people are generally spent their career in the military, whereas Bashir, you know, came out of a right-wing Islamist movement, and they made common cause for a number of decades. And you know, things have kind of gone back and forth in terms of the priorities and coalitions and relationships between the various conservative forces and the military and the Islamist parties. But so they do come from somewhat different traditions. They do have somewhat different priorities, but neither are democratic. Both, I think, are after their own agendas and not those of the people. But the point is that they may not have a choice. And that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people are calling this a coup d'etat, but in many ways it was a coup de grace, because at this point, people had were no longer listening or recognizing Bashir as a legitimate leader, and we're starting to see signs of the same kind of attitudes towards the military junta currently in charge.
And so this transition process that they have announced they will engage in, presumably that gives opposition groups a couple of years to organize, or maybe they'll demand elections sooner?
No, they're not going to wait a couple of years. Yeah. I mean, they're pushing for it now. There could be a fairly quick transition to democracy. There could be a brutal crackdown, but I do not see this dragging out for 2 years and people patiently waiting for the military to voluntarily step down.
How organized is the opposition? 30 years is a long time to live under a dictatorship. But of course, if you have a repressive dictatorship, organizing is also very, very difficult to do. Do you get the sense that there is, you know, are there political parties that are organizing or that could emerge or maybe could be formed from the basis of existing organizational structures?
Well, this is the big challenge right now, because and when you had these popular pro-democracy uprisings in 1964 and 1985, even though these also took place under military dictatorships, you still had a strong trade union movement. You had a controlled but somewhat independent judiciary. You had civil society organizations were vibrant, but under Bashir, it's been basically decimated civil society organizations, and so many ways, the people who are organizing today are doing so from scratch, and so it's going to be more difficult, I think, unfortunately, than in these previous struggles. But what's remarkable about this is that it is more diverse in the sense that you have it's intergenerational. Again, you have a lot of women involved. That's taking place not just in the capital, but across the country. And these are people who, having lived under this regime for quite a few years, have learned how to improvise, have learned how to get around all the restrictions and avoid the repressions. And as I also mentioned earlier, you know, there have been several aborted uprisings during the past 30 years. And so they also have a good idea of what doesn't work. And I think the lessons learned from these decades of struggle will be to their advantage, because from everything I can tell, they're determined to win this time.
Has there been a role by diaspora Sudanese around the world in helping their fellow countrymen in this grassroots organization, or has this been primarily led by those people inside?
It's certainly been primarily an internal struggle, but there is a fairly large educated Sudanese diaspora that has had to flee under the decades of this repression. People who still have close ties to their homeland, and for the minority of Sudanese who do have access to social media, there's been a lot of communication and support financially and otherwise. So this is very much an internal struggle, but it's important to have allies overseas, and indeed the Sudanese diaspora appears to be rising to the occasion.
What will happen to Omar al-Bashir? He has been arrested. There are numerous examples we could look back on in just the last 10 years or so for what ends up happening to deposed dictators. Most of them don't end up in a good place, but some basically live out the rest of their lives in house arrest or whatever.
It's hard to say. I mean, currently the regime says they're not going to turn him over to the International Criminal Court, I think in large part because a trial would implicate some of them as well
for
massive war crimes. But at the same time, there's an advantage to them to make him seem like a scapegoat. Like he was a bad guy. It was all his fault, and so we'll punish him for corruption or whatever. But again, I don't think the interim government's going to be in power that long. And what the what a new democratic Sudan should it emerge, inshallah, we can it'll be interesting to see what they do to in regard to him. And to the others who have oppressed them for so long.
Stephen, I want to take advantage of your presence on our program to switch gears completely in the last few minutes of our conversation. We've had very important elections taking place in Israel in just the last few days, with the re-election for a fifth term of right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That's a topic, of course, that I know you have focused on for many years, and we've had you on to talk about that. Many wondered if Netanyahu would win re-election. Initial reports showed that he was neck and neck with his rival, and then he emerged victorious. Does this spell deeply bad news for Palestinians?
I wasn't too surprised at the outcome, because we've seen in previous elections that Netanyahu has been tied or even slightly behind and emerged victorious, at least enabling him to put together coalitions with other right-wing and even far right-wing parties. It is certainly going to be worse in the short to medium term, though for some Palestinians are thinking, well, with him reelected, it's going to end even the pretense of a two-state solution, and it might advance the conversation perhaps of a binational a state, a single binational state, really mobilize world opinion more solidly, that we can't realistically hope for change, for reform, for compromise coming from the Israeli side. Of course, it's been very devastating. The people who are most devastated right now are not the Palestinians, because they didn't really expect much better from the centrist coalition that was running against him. But what's really devastating is what the remnants of the Zionists left. That is, I mean, the Labor Party, for example, which dominated Israeli politics for that country's first 25 years and played a major role. And at least for some periods subsequently, they only got six seats out of the 120 in Knesset. And in Meretz, which is slightly further left, but still Zionist party, got only four seats. And, so 10 out of 120 seats are representing this kind of labor Zionist tradition, which that many older Americans, at least in my generation, still see as Israel, with the kibbutz movement and right. The social democracy and the at least somewhat less overtly racist policies. And so in many ways, this symbolizes the death of left liberal Zionism. And Zionism has always been a diverse movement. I disagree with those who always try to depict it as the most reactionary, militaristic, racist component. But I don't think there's any question now that that very component now dominates the movement, dominates Israel. And it's not turning back, because I think the demographics have changed for a number of reasons. In part, generations who've grown up serving in the army and becoming occupiers, and that, to use the biblical phrase, hardens the heart. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it ossifies the racist militaristic ideology. And the other thing is simply demographic, that the very conservative Orthodox Israelis tend to have large families. The more liberal secular Israelis tend to have small families. And and it doesn't take very long in a country as small as Israel for that to reflect politically. Indeed, it's amazing how many people I know whose children have emigrated from Israel, now living in Europe and elsewhere, because they've given up about just how right-wing the country is becoming. So this is, even though the early American vision of Israel was even then somewhat over-idealized, at this point, that really no longer exists at this point. This is a racist, a militaristic country and government, and unfortunately, I don't see anything to change that direction in the foreseeable future.
Well, Stephen Zunis, always a pleasure to have you on and sharing your depth of knowledge about so many different issues. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Once again, my pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as the coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's also Senior Policy Analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and Associate Editor of Peace Review. We've been discussing primarily the political crisis and transition of power in Sudan with a little bit of Israel thrown in at the end. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.